way to do this. Let me show you a better way. You don't have to be another face in the crowd.
And we are live. Welcome, folks, to episode 3856 and the second episode of the podcast in the new recording studio, my new remodeled office. And on top of that, this will also be our very first interview in the new office. And I'm excited to have Joel Riles, who is a family friend and longtime member of our community and a longtime servant on our expert panel. He's answered your questions on dogs and dog training and other security issues for years. He's here today to talk about kind of a new lane that he is communicating through, which is the concept of self-defense as a system, which I think is a really great way to package things. Now, Joel's actually always taught this, but I think he's come up with kind of a new way to put that package together and make it more understandable recently. So we decided between us to get him on the show to talk about that today. But before we do, let's go ahead and thank our sponsors of the day. Sponsor of the day, number one today, is JM Bullion. Now, any of you guys that have been around for more than a minute know that I am a huge fan of Bitcoin. But Bitcoin, I'm a fan of it because it's hard money. And what I really am is a fan of hard assets. If you can own it for real, possess it, control it, convert it into other forms of capital, borrow against it, to me, that is a hard asset or a real asset. So real estate, certain equities, Bitcoin, gold, and silver all fit that niche. So I always want to have some silver and gold in my wealth assurance program. I recommend that you do too, up into about 5% of your net wealth is what I recommend in precious metals. But the decision of where to get it is really, really simple. JM Bullion has been sponsoring the show since 2013. Let me just say, since 2013, that's 13 years they've worked with us and supported us. They offer a discount for MSB members on orders of $300 and a higher discount at orders of $1,000. You can use those once a month. They have better pricing than Monex and Atmex, and if anything goes wrong, I can talk directly to their president. So my real question would be to you, why would you buy from anybody else when you're buying silver and gold? It's all the same. That's kind of the point. It's all fungible. Start 9 is our other sponsor of the day. This is how you can take back your privacy with a Start 9 privacy server. You can get your own, and you can do things like, yeah, you can run a Bitcoin wallet and a Bitcoin node or a Bitcoin Lightning node. That's great, and that's one thing it'll do, but it does a ton of other things for you. Stop operating in a crowd. Run your own program for password management. Run your own programs for file storage, for private communications, and other things like that. It's not hard. If you can install apps on a smartphone and use them, you can use a Start 9 Embassy server. Check them out today at start9.com. They also do a discount for MSB members, and I want to remind you when I say that, not only do they do a discount for members, they also offer 9% off if you use the Fold card when you make purchases using the gift card option on Fold. You can stack those. So you can get Bitcoin back, you can get another discount, and you can get a discount on top of that. They're really one of our great partners if you want to put things together that way. Check them out at start9.com. With that, I want to welcome our special guest, Joel Riles, back to the Survival Podcast. How you doing, Joel?
I'm doing great. How you doing, Jack?
I'm good, man. I mean, I'm in this brand new office, and I lost half my month to vacation like we were talking about at the beginning. So I'm scrambling like a one-legged man in an ass-kicking contest when I'm starting to dig out. I'm glad to have you on. It's like, I told Dorothy, who's my interview my first week back? She's like, Joel. I'm like, oh, great. I don't have to stress. I know it'll be great. But you've been around, like I said, for more than a minute, right? And I think I first interviewed you back in the teens of sometime, like 13, 14, somewhere in that range. Maybe earlier.
So.
Maybe earlier. I might have been in Arkansas. That'd put us in a 2012-11 time range.
Yep.
But there will be people that tune in today that don't know who a Jack Spirgo or a Joel Riles is for the first time. So can you give us kind of your backstory? Like, how did you get into training dogs and the stuff that you do now?
Well, you know, back in 2003, I was in the Army and I was deploying frequently as, you know, 9/11 had happened. And so, you know, the op tempo was really high. And because I was leaving so frequently, my now ex-wife, was like, hey, I want a protection dog while you're gone. I didn't really know anything about protection dogs at the time, but I linked up with this company in Canada. I got a puppy and I started training, and I just became completely obsessed with working these types of dogs. And after about 10 years of just working with them, I started breeding, selling, and training. And then it eventually turned into a full-time business. So our goal now is to help people feel safe and secure when you're doing things like I was doing, which is traveling and you're away from your family. How do I keep them safe when I'm gone? Well, you get a protection dog and the protection dog watches over them. Or when I'm moving in public and I'm concerned about, you know, a threat from somebody coming around the corner or whatever, I have my dog with me, and now I have somebody who can join in the fight and keep me safe if something happens, you know, while I'm moving in public. And so we just became completely obsessed with it. You know, the topic we're talking about today of having self-defense as a system, you know, really started to develop way back then. And then I got out of the military. I worked as a security guard for a little while because I needed something that didn't have any after work requirements. Being an officer in the military, you're never really off. You get home and try and, you know, relax, and they call you back in, or you got to get on and respond to an email. And so I did that for a while before I transitioned full time into this. And we've just been rocking and rolling ever since.
That's great, man. And I think that brings everybody up to speed. So you said that most people don't actually understand how violence works. And this has been a topic we visited a time or three over the years. The reality of violence is one of my earliest shows. And I agree with you, but can you kind of talk about what people get wrong about violence in of itself?
Yeah, you know, when I was helping a Navy SEAL buddy of mine, he used to do a lot of self-defense courses, and I would get calls from people who wanted to take, like, his knife defense course. And you could tell just by the way that they were asking questions and talking, what they wanted was, how do I defend myself against somebody who has a knife and never get cut? And it's like, no, that's not how actual violence works, right? We have visions of the movies where, you know, somebody gets shot and they fall over and stop moving. And it's like, no, when you shoot somebody, they scream and they move around on the ground and they might still shoot back. And unless you shoot them in the head or the spine, which most of the time is not what happens, you know, there's a lot of noise. There's blood everywhere. There's never enough blood in the movies. You know, the floor gets slippery. If you try to help a buddy who's been injured, he's bleeding all over you. And so the main thing people get wrong about violence is they expect that whatever they envision in their head, you know, a home invasion, they get this scenario in their mind, and then they're like, okay, that's how it's going to work. And it's like, it's never going to work the way you think it's going to work. The thing you have to ask yourself is, what can go wrong? The military has the whole Murphy's Law concept, right? And Murphy's Law is valuable to us because if you think about your situations that way, what can go wrong will go wrong is basically what Murphy's Law is you go through your scenario in your mind, and then you go, now, how could it go worse? Or how could I fail? Or how could this plan that I have not work? And then you've got to keep readjusting and readjusting. You can do that mentally, but the best way to do it is just to have a basic scenario, right? I mean, you can go through your house and have one of your kids or something like that. Just do pointy fingers with your hands and go pew pew at each other. And, you know, practice clearing a room and tell your kids they can hide somewhere. And if they shoot you first, they win, right? And you'll learn real quick. You don't know how to clear your house very well. And doing it with one or even two people is really difficult if somebody knows you're looking for them in the house. And so any little things like that, you know, people think, oh, I'm just going to clear my house this way. And then the first time you do it for real, you know, the guy was laying on the ground behind the couch and you never thought to look back there. And so just this idea of we think we know what it's going to be like is one of the biggest problems. And then the next thing that happens is, we think that we're going to think and we're going to act like we do when we're on a range or when we're, you know, in a drill with somebody. We don't take into consideration what's going to happen when the stress goes through the roof. The adrenaline hits your system. You can't process information like you can when you're just sitting there relaxing. And your body changes. You get tunnel vision. You get auditory exclusion. All of these problems. Sorry about that. And so... once that stuff happens, if you haven't accounted for it, your whole plan just falls apart.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think like coming from your end too, like you train protection dogs. Mm-hmm. And one of the nice things about that is if you have a dog in your home, even if it's not a protection dog, unless it's like some old dog that just sleeps so super hard, there's not a lot gets by a dog when it comes to somebody being in your house.
Absolutely.
And so I think there's value to a Dachshund. Not really on and not, I don't bet 20 of them. Get them, right? That could be kind of interesting, right? But and not so much on the dog will bite or control the intruder or whatever, but a dog that's going to go ape shit, right? Like I said, yep. Like you might not know somebody's behind the couch,
mm-hmm.
but a dog knows somebody who ain't supposed to be is behind that couch. Like, and I yep. think that so, and that's kind of where I'm leading with that is you have always presented dogs, not as security, but as a layer of security. Mm-hmm. And that kind of fits this whole as a system mindset.
Absolutely. Yeah. I like to, so when I think about the system itself, I'm like, first, we have to think properly. If you don't think about, you know, what self-defense actually is, then if you don't think about it properly, then you're not going to make any plans properly. Everything that you do is going to be either counterproductive or it's not going to work the way that you thought it was. And then once you have that set, then you can start building skills and tools on top of that. And so there's a lot of those, and we can go through those. And I always recommend, like, anything you're willing to do to increase your level of security is great. But at the end of the day, are most people going to do the things that they need to do to actually be prepared for that situation? And if you're living a normal life, probably not. Unless you just really like, you know, going to the MMA gym and fighting with people and going to the range and actually having a place that you can tactically train or something like that. And some of us just enjoy doing that stuff, and that's great. But if you're just a normal person trying to go to work and come home to your family, you're not going to want to invest that kind of time into it. So how do we set up something where you get the maximum that you're able or willing to put into your protection without you having to dedicate your whole life to it?
Yeah, I would agree, because even the people that do go to the gym and train MMA, they probably don't spend as much time maybe as somebody else does at the range, or they don't spend mm-hmm. as much time working with their dogs. Like, we all have the thing we like, and we gravitate to the thing that we like. And therefore, our weakness is always the thing that we don't like. And,
yep.
you know, people that train really hard will say, well, I don't really like it. It's hard. You got to embrace the sucker. Whatever. But in the end, those dudes like it, right? You know what I'm yep. talking about. Those guys like, they might, like, there's a lot of things I like to do. And when I'm not in motion and I'm not really in the mood, yeah, at that moment, maybe it's like, I don't really want to do this. But once like those things I'm talking about, once you move into actually the action of doing them, then you
right.
really enjoy them. Like, even just writing, it's not related to what we're talking about, but like, I'm doing a lot of writing right now. I'm like, I don't want to write. But, you know, three sentences in, then you're in flow. And so that flow is good because it makes us good at the thing we like to do, but it can also suck us away from shoring up because you have a gun on you, and that's really great until the guy that you're in a conflict with is 18 inches away from you, and uh-huh. he weighs 100 pounds more than you, and he's got his hand on your wrist crushing your hand blue that your gun's
yep.
in, right?
Yep.
Like, so we always have to have multiple options.
Or even before you can draw it. Yeah,
yeah.
I always reference a friend of mine. His name's James. We call him Machete James kind of as a joke because he's the dude, the only guy I know who's actually been in a life and death threat situation. And he made it out, but he was, you know, he was in the military. He was in the SOAR unit, the helicopter unit with the special operations guys. So he had been in some firefights.
For those who don't know, that's big time.
Yes. And he had been in firefights. He'd been in rescues and stuff like that. So, you know, a capable dude, but he was out of the military and he was just working at a construction company. And what they would do is it was day labor. So these guys would show up, they'd sign up with their specialty, and then James's company would assign them to job sites, and they'd take these guys out and drop them off. And then at the end of the day, they'd pick them up, and that was what he did. And so he came back to the office after dropping some guys off, was just, you know, filling out the whiteboard, doing normal admin stuff when he got back, and heard thwap behind him. And he was like, what? Turned around. And there was a dude with a machete that had just swung it at the girl in the office behind him. And thankfully, the dude sucked at swinging machetes, and he just kind of grazed her head. And it kind of bent the machete over a little bit when he did it. And so James turns around, and this dude is the guy that carries concealed, and he gets dressed every morning, and he stands in front of the mirror and draws his pistol like five times before he leaves the house every day to make sure that the clothes he's wearing today aren't going to interfere with his ability to draw his weapon. So he knows how to draw. He knows how to shoot. He's been in the shit before. And he turns around and his brain is like, what the hell is, what am I seeing? What's going on here? And it takes you a second to process that information, to even realize you need to draw your gun. And then the guy was about, I would guess, 12, 15 feet away when he turned around. Dude charges at him. He draws his pistol, fires twice, hits the guy in the forearm once and missed with the second round. And then they're on the ground. Machete goes one way. Pistol goes the other way. They're down there wrestling for about 10 seconds on the ground. And then the girl that had been hit, she goes to run, trips over a chair, makes a bunch of noise, and the guy jumps up and chases her, and then the situation's over. And I'm like, that guy was about as prepared as you can be for a situation like that, and it still all went to shit. I mean, thankfully he survived, and nobody died that day, and the guy was eventually arrested about 2 days later. But, you know, that's how real violence works. It's not like, oh, I'm just going to turn around and I'm going to totally know what to do when the bad thing starts to happen. And I'm just going to draw my gun and pull the trigger and end the threat.
Yeah, 100%, man. So we part of this, like, just as you're describing that, the stress level, like, I think there's and like this guy at least had been in this shit and still the stress level's there. Right. I think you can tell when somebody gets into a fight or a physical conflict when it's their first time.
Oh yeah.
Like the second that it actually goes kinetic, there's a expression that I can't describe, but I absolutely know it when I see
when
it. I think most people do. And so that, I don't care if they've trained, but they haven't actually been in a kinetic situation before, that happens. And so how do we train sufficiently that eventual reality can be overcome? Because even once you've been through it, it's still there. And I think like the person that doesn't write it off is the person who's been through it, but they still need to keep working at it.
Yeah. So real quick about what happens to your body when stress goes through the roof and you get all of the hormones, you know, flooding your system that you get when you're in a fight or flight, as they say, situation. The first thing is your cognitive ability, your ability to think and process information pretty much goes to zero, especially if for whatever your level of stress is, if you're above your level of stress that you can handle, your ability to think disappears. And we all have this normalcy bias, which is what I was describing when James turned around and was like, what am I seeing? Because your brain doesn't turn around expecting to see a guy with a machete that just walked into the back office and swung it at somebody. So your brain's sitting there going, what the heck is this? You know, most of what we see in life, we recognize it before we even see it because we see it all the time. We know what it is. So when something's way out of the ordinary, that's when normalcy bias kicks in and our brain's trying to figure out what the heck is this I'm even seeing. Your fine motor skills go to shit. So your ability to do any kind of fine motor skill, up to and including even drawing a weapon, can get really, really sloppy. You very often get tunnel vision. So because all your capillaries tighten up to put all the major blood into your major muscle groups and your organs to help you operate at ideal capability, it makes it so when all the blood goes out of your hands, it makes moving your hands in fine motor ways very limited, but it also makes your vision narrow down. And it can be as bad as like looking through a straw, right? And that's all you see. We often get auditory exclusion. So if you've ever been excited to shoot your first deer or like when I would shoot caribou in Alaska, like you pull the trigger, you don't feel the recoil and you don't hear the blast. That's auditory exclusion, right? And it's just because we were excited. We have the adrenaline in our blood. And then the other one is we often get time distortion. So either we get fast motion time, which usually means you weren't prepared. Everything just happened real quick and you're like, what happened? Or you get slow motion time, which is a good one if you know how to deal with it because it does literally feel like you're moving in slow motion. But it also allows you to think and see things and to react in ways that you wouldn't otherwise be able to react. And so when those things happen, that's all a reaction to stress. Now, how do we make our stress level that we can handle higher? The military calls that stress inoculation. And you can do it in two ways. The ideal way to do it is to physically go through the stress. So if you go to a gym and just wrestle with people, right, just sparring, your ability to handle like hand-to-hand stuff is going to be way higher than somebody who's never been punched before or never been, you know, grappled, never been submitted, any of that kind of stuff. You'll, that level of stress will feel normal to you if you do it often enough, right? And the way that we make things normal is we do them so frequently that they're not stressful anymore. So our tier one operator guys, they clear buildings so often that it's boring. They don't get stressed when somebody's shooting back at them. Now, they might get shot, but they're not stressed in the moment of seeing somebody lift a rifle and point it at them because I've done this 1,000 times. This is normal to me now. And so your ideal situation is to do it that way. But that takes a lot of time, and depending on what it is, it could take a lot of money too, right? Like firing rounds or things like that. So most people don't have the time and the money to invest into truly building stress inoculation at the levels they would need to for a fight. So the other thing we can do is our subconscious doesn't know the difference between make-believe and real life. So if you envision scenarios in your head, this is why athletes and stuff like this use the, you know, envisioning winning, or the fighter pilots will sit and envision, you know, flying their jets and being in dogfights and stuff like that, because you're training your subconscious when you do that. So what happens in a super high stress situation, the reason your brain, your cognitive brain shuts off is because your subconscious is taking over, right? And whatever your subconscious has been trained to do is most likely what you're going to do. And a lot of people don't understand that. So an analogy that makes sense is if you've ever driven a stick shift, when you first start to drive, it applies to regular cars too, right? When you very first start to drive, you're so focused on staying in the lane and not going, you know, not speeding, and but actually staying close to the speed limit, not driving too slow. And what do I do with my feet? And can I reach over and change the channel on the radio? And every single thing you have to do becomes a lot of work, and you're all nervous, and you, you know, you're sloppy at everything that you're doing because you're having to focus on way too many things all at once. But after you've driven for 5 years, you can text on your phone, drive with one hand, put your knee on the wheel and reach over and change the station on the radio all at once. And most of the time you can stay in your lane while you're doing that. Right. And so, you practice things until they become normal. So you can do that physically, which is the ideal way to do it. But you can also do it by spending time envisioning and thinking through, you know, sitting in your living room in the evening, watching TV and just pausing for a minute and going, if somebody kicked the door in right now, what would I do? Where's the gun? Where's the dog? Where are the kids at? Where's my wife? What's everybody's job if that happens? You know, is the wife supposed to get the kids? Are we all going for the guns? What are we going to do in this situation? And you just think about it and actually like envision doing it in your head. Now, the downside to that is if you envision doing it in a way that's not going to work, then when you need it, you're going to do something that doesn't work. But both of those things will increase your ability to deal with stress. So at that point, then you get into, now I've got to have the tools and the skills to actually function when that stress happens.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that one of the things that happens is the exact opposite, which is instead of running through the scenarios with multiple variables, people want the shortcut for the mind.
Yes.
In some of my writing I've been doing lately, I've been digging deep into the psychological and neuroscientific reason that people do what they do.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things you discover when you go down that path is the brain is an energy hog,
yep.
Right? The brain uses more calories than any other part of our body, right?
Yep.
And so the body makes a conscious or subconscious effort actually to conserve energy that goes to the brain. So we actually filter like 95% of what comes in, we filter out. And so if the mind can be comforted with, well, if A happens, I'll just do B.
Absolutely.
Then the mind is totally content to go, okay. Right. And that primitive brain of ours, that reptile brain, that, you know, that brain stem part of our psyche says,
yep.
Okay, we got this. The lion in the jungle is a threat, but we have a plan. So don't worry about the lion anymore.
Right.
And the sheer number of variables of what can happen in like a home invasion, just one scenario,
mm-hmm.
don't worry about like in a parking lot while you're getting into your car, while you're getting out of your car, when you're in a store, right? Like just a home invasion. Well, is it in the morning or the evening? Is it in the middle of the day? Like you said, who's home?
Right.
Like, you break in here right now, you got a big problem because I got two dogs, I'm armed, and I don't have to worry about anything except my spot.
Right.
I don't have to worry about like, okay, I have to go clear because my wife's, you know, on the other side of the house or upstairs. Now right. I have to move because you're isolating me from who I need to protect. Right yep. now, it's and so those two scenarios are different. Now, if you got a split home and you got two kids and one's each in a bedroom and your master yep. bedroom's up, like, okay, and it's the middle of the night, that is it an invader? Or did your 15-year-old girl sneak out the window and she's just coming home, right?
Exactly. Like, or your kid that's in college that variables. Got drunk and was like, dad lives close, we'll go over there.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, like.
Yeah, and it's uncomfortable to think about these things, which is why most people don't want to do it.
Yeah.
And, you know, jumping ahead a little bit, and we can come back and go through some of the skill sets and stuff, but that's actually the reason Fortress Canine exists, is because most people are not going to invest the time and energy that they need to truly be prepared for a situation. And whether or not we ever had the skill set to just kind of be naturally hypervigilant and always ready for something to happen, or whether we've always been like we are now and you know, have to work at it, the dogs, yeah, you guys like the smoke signals? I like being down in a place where I can work and smoke at the same time. But the dog is always in that state. Because they're a predator, they always live in the predator mindset. And so they're ready to go whenever something happens, especially if they've been trained to deal with a human threat. Once you teach a dog to be trained to deal with a human threat and you introduce them to some basic scenarios, like it's okay to bite somebody inside the house if they're aggressive.
Yeah.
And, you know, if it's a guest coming over or the kids walking through the door, leave them alone, relax. But if it's somebody kicking our door in or three or four dudes running in aggressively, now you have to act. And you're basically just teaching them you have permission to do this in this situation. Yeah. If somebody goes hands-on with your people, you have permission to bite them. If somebody invades our vehicle, you have permission to bite them. And then they can go from a totally relaxed, calm state to full-on aggression just like that. And all you have to do as the handler is maintain basic obedience in the dog when you're living your normal life.
Yeah, yeah. And again, I'm back to like the canine senses. Like mm-hmm. If somebody breaks into your house and they smell like a garbage dump, you'll probably smell them. But if they just took a shower in pine soap, right? Yep. Like deer cover, like the dogs are like, bro. And one thing I've learned about them,
yeah.
they may not know what it is, but they're never yes. wrong when they tell you something is.
Yes.
When they say there's something, there is something. Yep. I promise you, like no matter what, like we had one time, just my little, I had a lab chow mix. You know, he was trained for nothing other than don't do a deuce in the house. That was all the training right. he had. But he was insistent. There was something in my son's backpack. This is back when Matthew was like in junior high. And man, we took everything out of it. We like, bro, there's nothing. And he's like, there's, right? And somehow in one of the pockets, there was a little whitefoot deer mouse. And mm-hmm. after he put everything back in and set it down, all of a sudden, here comes a little head
yep. out of the.
And it's like that dog, and not like he went past it and went, oh, there it is. It was like across the room. You see the ears, right? And
yep.
they can
yep.
detect that.
Absolutely. Like,
then somebody sneaking into a house. I'm not saying it can't be done. I'm saying it's a hell of a lot less likely.
Yeah, and I mean, like you mentioned earlier, there are some dogs that are just super lazy and
yeah.
have no like instinct to protect the environment
or
that they're in. But
human years
dogs,
are 111, right? Like they're
yeah.
just old, you know.
But most dogs, I often describe it this way: almost all dogs are protective. And what yeah. I mean by protective is, if a stranger walks in, they'll bark at them.
Yeah.
Right? They're like, you
yeah.
don't belong in my area. This is my space. Only my family and people that come over normally belong here. You're a stranger. I'm going to bark at you. Now, that doesn't mean that they're going to engage or protect or anything like that, but they're protective over their environment.
Yep.
And, you know, we often think with dogs, oh, it's their sense of smell. But and their sense of smell is definitely way better than ours, like, you know, a million times stronger than our sense of smell is. But they also, their hearing in those ranges that we can hear is about like ours is, except for they can hear higher and lower pitches than we can. So, like, I actually did years ago, I volunteered to be Op 4, that's the bad guys, in some sniper competitions. And I wanted to see, can I use my dogs to hunt down snipers in these competitions? And these competitions had everything from weekend warrior guys to actual military snipers that were doing, and they had to move different places and they had to do things. And we were out there hunting them. And I would get up on like a little hill, you know, just not even something big, just where we can kind of have a good view of the surrounding area. And I'd look with my binoculars, but I almost never found them with the binoculars. What I would do is I'd watch my dog. And she'd just be laying there relaxed, and all of a sudden she'd alert. She'd look up, ears would go forward, and she'd stare in a direction. And I'd look at her, and I'd look with the binoculars where she was looking, and I'd look down, and I'd look. And sure enough, every time she did that, we found a team. And then I'd wait for them to go by something like a landmark, a tree or something that I could identify, and we'd move to that, and then I'd cast her off, and we'd track them down from there. And what she was picking up on was the squeaks in their backpacks and things. Now, they had taped everything up. If you've ever been in the military, you get your rucksack on, and you kind of jump up and down, and you move around, and you listen for, you know, something that's dangling, that's clacking against the metal piece or anything that's squeaking, and you tape it up so that it's quiet. But we're doing it for what we can hear. We miss all the pitches that are above and below our range that we can hear. The dogs still pick that up. And so they've got their smell, they've got their ears, and they just have something in them. And, you know, some people will say it's spiritual, but there's something in the dog that can detect when things are out of the ordinary in their environment. They're hyper in tune with their environment. And so, like, just like you said, when a dog alerts, always pay attention to it. It could be a possum or a raccoon out the door, or it could be a bad guy. And most of the time, it's probably not going to be a bad guy. But when they give you that alert, pay attention.
Something. It's always so. One of the ways I contrast it, like, and how humans, this is in us too, but we are too clean and we are too at peace in some ways. Even people that seem very angry, they're too at peace with, like, the stability of reality. And kind of the way I explain this is when I was in the military, and I wasn't in for very long, and I didn't do anything special or anything, but I did get to do a couple times where I was on op four because, you know, they say don't volunteer. I'm like, I'm short. I'll volunteer for everything. I want all the experience while I'm here. You know? I'm not staying in for life. And so I'd volunteer for everything. And the one time we did op four, we literally went into the jungle like 5 days before the guys in the FTX went in. So we're out there living. We're getting the lay of the land. We're planning attacks. But what we're not doing is we're not showering. I mean, we're doing, you know, the crotch bath and stuff like that because we don't have it. So there's no hair product. There's no skin product. There's no soap, right? You're living out in this. And when those guys came to the field, when they would try to do any kind of maneuvers, you could freaking smell them.
Yep.
Because they were clean, because they had soap on them. If you had gone there the same day, you would have never done that.
Yep.
Right? And so to me, like, I always think about that with a dog. Like, so this is, like, the dog is, like, 10 times better than this all the time.
Yep.
Just with the nose, let alone the ears. Now, you've said they can't hear better than us, as in distance to volume. And I agree with you. Attenuation, because I've had dogs that they'll listen like that. Bells like that. Now, if I whistle and she doesn't come, she can't hear you. And you can see the dog, and the dog can see you, but the wind's blowing really hard, you yell, they just don't hear you.
Yep.
But what they can hear is beyond our range in decibels. And they can hear things that we can't hear, not because they hear quieter sounds, but they hear outside of our bandwidth of what we can hear. And so there's things that they'll pick up on smell, or, like, they don't see the color we do, but they see contrast totally different. So they'll see a movement. Yep. I've had dogs, like, you're hunting, and that dog's like that, and, like, no sound. You know there's wind. You know they didn't hear it. They saw something or they smelled something, and instantly they alerted. And like I've said, it may not be what you're looking for.
Yeah.
But they're never wrong.
Yes.
There's
if they could talk to us, it'd be awesome, because they could be like, that's a person or that's a raccoon. Because they probably know when
they're probably know what it is.
Don't know.
Like, I see it kind of like the movies with like the robots, the Terminator, and, like, it's like spinning in a circle like a hologram, and it's a possum. Possum.
Yes.
Goes to plays dead, not worth eating, smells bad, like, in their brain, but they can't communicate that with us. Someday, not now, but someday I'll have to tell you about the children's story that I have in my head that involves dogs talking.
That'd be awesome.
So let's go back to self-defense as a system, right? Instead of just a tool, like, I think people are like, what's your self-defense plan? Well, I have a gun, right? Or I have a dog, or I have an alarm system, or I have all three. But those are the things. They're not the system that link the things together into an actual system.
Right. So your basic system, the overall outline of it is you get your mindset right where you're thinking properly about what's an actual situation going to be like if it happens. So you don't have these false perceptions of how things are actually going to go. Then on top of that, you add your tools and your skill sets. So things like alarms and locks and cameras, those are good for detecting and recording. But once a situation starts, they don't do anything after that. So they can help you know somebody's there, or they can help you know that somebody's, you know, opened a window or a door and the alarm goes off. And a lot of times that will be a deterrent that'll scare somebody off if they're like trying to sneak and peek and not actually, you know, have anybody know that they're there. But in a home invasion situation, if they can get inside the house and turn that alarm off, they don't care if you know that they're there or if the alarm's going off. And so the tools are good, but they have to be used in a way that's actually effective. And when you start looking at how to use the tools, that's where your skills come in. So like you said, they've got a gun, and even let's say they carry concealed, but how often do they practice drawing that gun from concealment and using it? And, you know, you need the mindset to know I need to draw it. And then you got to have the skill of actually drawing it and being able to put a round on target. And there's a statistic that I read years ago that was done by the New York Police Department. And in shootings with police officers, the average number of hits in a shooting was 1 in 5 rounds. So you would fire 5 rounds and you hit the bad guy once. And we go to the range and we qualify and we can, you know, maybe we get a perfect 40 out of 40 at the range, but targets aren't shooting back and they're not moving. And so as soon as the targets are moving, you're moving and the stress is there. And they're shooting back at you, so you're trying to take cover and all this other kind of stuff, at least if you're thinking properly, then the ability to hit a target goes drastically down. So even doing things like I saw somebody earlier commented about, you know, Nerf, and you like that can be a very valuable way to practice. You know, you want to make sure that you're not doing that so often that you don't know how the mechanics of your actual gun work,
which is why
I like airsoft, because you can get pretty much mirror images of your firearms in airsoft and practice with them, and the mechanics are almost identical to your actual weapon. I like Glocks and I like AR. So I've got AR airsoft guns and I've got Glock airsoft guns. And you're going through the motion. You're not getting the full recoil or the sound from them, but all of the motions are there to actually practice your skill sets, and you can shoot back at each other. Now, I will warn you, if you're doing airsoft inside your house, they do puncture drywall or at least put dents in it. So if that's a thing you're concerned about, they might break glass on like a picture on the wall or something like that.
Yeah.
But if you have like a little spot you can set up in a garage or something like that, where you just take sheets of plywood and put little, you know, legs on them so they stand up, and you can rearrange them and practice, you know, clearing corners and stuff, and just have somebody stand back there, and when they see you, shoot you. So if they see a foot, shoot it. If you see a knee peek around the corner, shoot the knee or an elbow. And you a lot of things people don't think about when they're clearing is there's a lot of nuance to actually moving around a corner when there could be somebody on the other side of that that's going to shoot back at you. If you have your elbow up, like a lot of people practice at the range, and they have good stances for shooting accurately, but if you try to do that while you're clearing a corner, your elbow's sticking out too far, and they see your elbow before the gun even clears the corner. And, you know, if you've ever been even shot with a paintball in the elbow, you know, if that was a real round, I'm in big trouble right now.
In some ways, you might be instantly in more trouble than you would with a wound that's eventually mortal, because the arm isn't going to work now. I've seen gunfights, not in person, but I've seen, you know, after action reviews where dude's hit twice in the torso and continues to move. I've never seen somebody hit in the elbow that could then use their arm. Like, well, you shatter that arm is it makes me think. Remember, did you see the movie on Benghazi?
And I probably
the actor that played Marcus Luttrell, like his arm got all tore up. And at the end of it, when they're carrying him out, he's like, look at my arm. And it's just like, because he's so in the head, right? Like, and his arm just won't. And he's like, and they're like, stop messing with it, right?
Yeah.
And I think that's actually some of the mentality we're talking about, too. Like that, like there's a point where there's enough endorphin and everything moving in that you don't even sense pain. But when you mechanically disable a limb, right, then that's not – I don't care if he keeps moving. He's not using that hand anymore. On the airsoft, a couple little extras. Number one, do not discount what Joel said about damage to your house. When we got really big into training with airsoft, we did some airsoft training at one of the workshops about 2018, I think. And David brought this trailer with like a backup power system in it to show everybody how it worked. It was a typical boxed metal skin trailer. And it was parked, I bet you that thing was a good 35 yards from the shop.
Mm-hmm.
And people, including David, so he did it himself, were sitting there with my PTR, my professional training rifle AR, and shooting the trailer. And when we went up, it was just dents all in that metal skin.
Yep.
Number two, if you play around and shoot each other with airsoft, it is very important that, one, you wear eye protection.
Yep.
It will take an eye. And two, you have distance rules of engagement. I know the bad guy won't follow that, but training's training. There has to be protocols. And
yep.
I like, for instance, I saw a thread on when rules of engagements are not obeyed in like where they the kids go play airsoft. And
yep.
this one guy had literally, it looked like a weird punk piercing.
Mm-hmm.
He had like 8 pellets in the rim of his ear. Like,
yep.
I don't even know how that happened that way, but it was like they were perfectly stacked. Maybe it wasn't 8. It was probably like 5 or 6. But
yep.
they were right, like if that's the rim of the ear, they were stacked on top of each other, embedded into the back of the ear. So
yep.
especially with your kids, guys. Just, but it's great training. Like we used to use it when I used to train with Valery Asanoff. And what he would do is he'd have you engaging somebody else, and he's standing there. He's not a target. He'd have
right.
a 5-gallon bucket full of tennis balls.
Mm-hmm.
And while you're being attacked by 2 people, he's throwing tennis balls at your face.
Yeah. Because
you might not care that you get hit with a pellet, but when a 6'4" Russian dude that can throw a ball 60, 70 miles an hour hits you in the face with it,
yep.
that you care about. And it simulates that. And like, that's all we can do is simulate, right? Like,
yeah. Well, and the other big benefit to something like airsoft is, as opposed to just doing like dry firing or blue guns or even the Nerf stuff, is if there is pain associated with getting hit, you get a much better stress test, right? You actually mm-hmm. get to feel it, it's not at quite the same level as a full firearm, but most people don't want to experience pain. And
yeah.
if they've not, like I used to play paintball and we were kind of like getting ready to be professionals. We never actually like went and competed. At least, you know, I moved on and did other things before that happened. But you do get to the point where you've been shot with paintball so many times, you don't care. It doesn't, you can get hit in the hands and you're like, eh, no big deal. But the first couple times you play and you get hit with those paintballs, it's like, oh crap, this hurts. And now you go out on the field and you're like, I don't want to get hit. I don't want to get hit. And you're all nervous and you actually get to experience the stress
yeah.
of, this is going to hurt if something happens. And that happens in airsoft a lot. I've seen it. We were doing law enforcement training a lot with airsoft. And people would just, they would totally shut down
yeah.
because they weren't even being shot. And they were wearing like full helmets
oh, yeah.
and pads.
Yeah.
And they're
yeah.
still nervous that, oh, my hand, I might get hit in the hand. And it's like, yeah, you're going to get hit in the hand. Like, just do your job anyway. But that's another thing in the mindset is, you know, we mentioned earlier about the I want to defend myself against a knife and not get hit. The way I say it is, if you're in a gunfight, there's a high probability you're going to get shot. If you're in a knife fight, you're going to get cut. And if you're in a fist fight, you're going to get punched. You have to mentally prepare yourself that I will continue fighting until I win and this threat is over. The ambulance
yeah.
can be called and we can all get patched up after the fact, but you have to go in and fight, fight, fight. There's actually been some studies done where people would be shot with like a 22 in the upper arm and it doesn't break a bone or anything.
Yeah.
And they will literally fall down like they're dead because
yeah.
they in their mind thought, when you get shot, that's what people do.
Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
criminals, on the other hand, they live in a world of violence. So
yeah.
they don't have that block in their head. And when you shoot them, if you have a mechanical wound, like you said, in an elbow or a knee or you shatter a hip or something like that, those are effective hits because you take away an ability to function. If you shoot somebody in the torso, pistols suck at killing people. So they're effective if that's the only thing you can carry. But the reason people carry pistols and not rifles is because you can hide them easier. It's not
yeah.
because they're effective at killing people. The ballistics
yeah.
on, and everybody argues over 9mm or 45 or whatever. They all suck.
Irrelevant. It's irrelevant.
44 Magnum maybe is the only one, and maybe some of these 50 cals now that they
yeah.
got out there. You know, maybe those have good terminal ballistics on them. But anything you're going to carry on a day-to-day basis is not great at killing people. You have to shoot somebody 4 or 5 times in the torso to fairly quickly kill them. And even then, they can go for a minute or so anaerobic and function. And And so, like, when I was training with tier one guys, they would tell me the process you go through in your head is every time you pull the trigger, you go, did it hit? Did it work? Did it hit? Did it work? Did it hit? Did it work? And you keep pulling the trigger until it worked. So, you know, yeah. I need to be hitting my target, but I got to keep hitting my target until they stop being a threat to me. And, yeah. And if you don't have that mentality going into it and you shoot somebody, and even if you're hitting them in the torso, but they're not reacting, because a lot of times they won't when their adrenaline's super high, you might think you're missing. And in your brain, all of a sudden now you're thinking, why am I missing, or why is this person still attacking me? Instead of thinking what I need to be thinking to actually put that threat down, which is keep pulling the trigger, keep pulling the trigger. And again, though, in these situations, there was a study where they said, how many rounds do people fire on average in a gunfight? And they looked at all the statistics, and it was interesting because when people carried revolvers, when the police carried revolvers, the average number of shootings in a gunfight were 6. And when people moved to semi-automatic handguns, the early magazines were 13, right? It went to 13. And what happens is you pull the trigger sometimes until you run out of ammunition, whether you're hitting the target or not. Yeah. And then when you reload, your brain actually has a second to kind of reset. And then you go, oh, the threat's down, or oh, they ran away, or oh, whatever it is. And now I can actually like process what just happened. And just that quick, I did a reload, and now I'm reevaluating the situation. And so all of those things have to be taken into consideration. And if you don't practice them, you're not going to be ready when you know the shit goes down and you're just like, oh no, what do I do?
Yeah. And there's people out there right now thinking, but I have seen real life footage of a person hit once in the chest, they go down and they're dead.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. What Joel's talking about is probabilities and percentages. And I can tell you, I covered this, God, this has to be 2009. I know it was still in my car when I covered this. It was kind of an informal study of a guy that looked up all the reported incidences of shootings he could find.
Yep.
And it was one shot stops, one shot lethality.
Yep.
And lethality overall, like, you know, even with multiple hits. And he compared everything from 22s up to even the 44 Magnum. And there was no statistical difference until he went to rifles and shotguns. And when he went to rifles and shotguns, there was an immediate leap in a statistical difference. But even that wasn't 100%.
Right.
And that study only looked at shots to areas that would be considered lethally potential. So, like, basically upper thighs, you got the femoral, the lower body, the torso, the face, and the neck. So they weren't counting hits in the forearm or something. And it was still no statistical. 9mm 45, absolutely the same. People say, you shoot a 45, Jack, because, you know, that's just, you're a FUD. You're an old man. And, you know, no, I shoot a 45 because I like the 1911. It's the best round for the 1911. And I've been shooting one since I was 7 years old. And I don't worry about, well, do you need a 40 or I don't worry about that because I'm comfortable with the frame and the round as to putting rounds on target. But I completely agree with you. Yep. And, you know, Hollywood is just, I can't watch action movies or even action TV series because the guy gets shot, he always goes blows through the window and shit. Even if you drop somebody when you shoot them, they just go down. They don't go. Is even if the guy gets shot with a 9mm, he's blown through a window. You shoot a deer with a 30-06.
Yep.
It
does not
runs,
get knocked back.
It either runs or it drops. It does not get knocked back, right? Yeah.
Right. Yep. Yeah, and when you're looking at tools and stuff like that, the reason rifles and shotguns, well, shotguns put either a bunch of smaller holes in you all in one shot or a much bigger hole with a slug. And so that's why shotguns are more effective. And sometimes with a shotgun, you might actually knock somebody, like they might lose their balance from the impact because it is kind of like getting punched in the chest really hard.
I'll give you this. If the guy's wearing ballistic armor so he doesn't get a penetration and you hit him with a 75 caliber Foster slug out of a 12-gauge, he probably is going backwards then because the energy is transferred onto the body instead of into the body. But
which in some situations might almost be worse for functionality than having it go straight through you.
Mythbusters did a thing where they hung up of like a 200-pound pig on a hook, and they put the thing holding it like just at the tip where like if you walked up to it and shoved it, it would
come
fall.
Off.
They shot it with everything. The only thing that even knocked it off the hook was the 12-gauge with a slug.
Mm-hmm.
Like buckshot didn't do anything. Like it was the slug and it just went Like, that's all it did. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, what rifles do, and, you know, we don't need to get into a huge conversation on ballistics, but rifles is because of the speed of the bullet, which is why something like a 223 is still, especially if you don't have full metal jackets, any kind of expanding round, is the speed of the round actually creates a cavity so that when it impacts, it creates a cavity that expands and then drops down. So if you've ever watched ballistic gelatin being shot in slow motion with these rounds, you can actually see it, right, as it goes through. Well, if you hit anywhere in the upper torso with that, it will explode a lung, right? So you hit somebody in either of their lungs and it expands the lungs so much that it just rips it to pieces.
Yeah.
And it, when it comes back together, it's just non-functional. You can explode a heart that way too. But like liver shots, kidney shots, anything like that with those rounds are way more devastating. But just like we said, if somebody's really determined and they're focused, they may not even register that anything's set. Now they're dead. They're like,
yeah, they're dead on their feet, but they can still act.
They can still operate.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of that really depends on how determined the person is in attacking you.
There was a guy that got robbed near where my dad had a gas station when I was a kid, and he kept a shotgun behind the counter. And when the guy, like, he had a gun pointed at him, asked for the money, and when he moved that gun off him, that dude pulled that gun, that sawed-off double barrel, hit him in the head, blew half his head off. The dude runs out the door and ran about 40 yards and then fell dead.
Yep.
Now, if he could run 40 yards, he could blindly fire, I mean, like, there's a, how do I put this? There's been a lot of people killed by a person that was already dead. Just didn't know it yet, right? It's the zombie one, like always double tap. I think that was one of the zombie things.
Exactly. Was that zombie?
It was like Bill Murray in it, whichever one that one was.
Yeah, yeah. Stretch before you go to the bathroom.
Yeah, that one.
I don't know. We just watched the second one of those a couple of weeks ago. It was hilarious. I love those movies.
So there's a ton of like YouTube channels, influencers. There's a ton of stuff just dedicated to like after action reviews of shootings and all. But do you see maybe in self-defense training, online commentary, all that, like some specific areas where there's generally weaknesses?
So where most of the weaknesses come in, especially on the training side, is anyone who, if you're looking for training from people, any instructor who tells you do this and it will work, run from that person. And one of the things that we try to teach all of our people when we're training them to take their protection dogs home is the situation is never going to work the way you think it's going to work. It's always going to be different. And you stack as many things in your favor as you can, and then you hope it works out if everything falls apart, right? If the actual situation happens, you just want to stack as many things in your favor as you can. And so you cannot get into the mindset of, oh, if this happens, I'm going to do that. It's if this happens, we're going to do all these things and hopefully something works, right? And so when you're getting into the weaknesses, it's, you know, people don't understand ballistics. People don't understand like the movement that happens in a fight. People don't understand closing distance. Both, like, I would rather have a knife if I'm like 3 feet away from a person than a gun, because a knife's a lot harder to take. If you've ever done disarming techniques, the main reason they teach disarming techniques to police officers is not so we can take a gun from somebody. It's so that you know, don't ever let anyone get this close to you, because it's very easy to take a gun from someone. You might get shot in the process, but if you can get your hands on that gun, grabbing a barrel gives you a lot better leverage than the grip of a pistol.
Yep.
If you're going to practice that, by the way, and you're the one holding the gun, do not put your finger in the trigger guard, because you will get it broken or ripped off. When somebody grabs the barrel of the gun and they point it up at the sky, that trigger guard will tweak that finger.
Or inward and backward. It'll rip the flesh off the finger.
Yes. So, you know, the big thing is you do not – okay, my Navy SEAL buddy says, why do we use guns instead of knives? It's because we can use them at a distance. We don't have to get close to the person. Once you're close – if somebody grabs the blade of a knife, unless they've got you confined and your arms are confined and you can't move, you can pull it away. You can just, any torque or tension in any direction is probably going to start slicing and cutting. And if it's sharp, they may not feel the instant pain, but you're creating that damage, right? And you're taking away, every time there's a slash, you hit those tendons and those ligaments and those muscles, and you reduce the effectiveness of that hand or arm every time it happens.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of variabilities there, like, you know, just switching hands or something. I saw this little short video one time. It's like this dude, and he's doing all the self-defense stuff. He's got this little Asian chick, and she's got this little plastic knife, right? And so she goes to attack him, and he does, like, this double-handed block. And she just drops it, grabs it with the other hand, and hits him in the head with it. Like,
yep. And
they're being funny, but they're also making a point. Like,
yes.
A lot of these things that people watch videos of and think, well, I'll just do that. No, you won't. No, you
right.
Nobody attacks you with a knife like, ugh, right? Like,
right.
I understand why we train that way, so that you can learn mechanics. But at some point, if you actually want to train in disarming techniques, you got to suit up, and you know, you like, we used to wear black, all black,
yep.
And then chalk mark the blade of a training knife.
Red lipstick
and
works good
for
that
sure,
kind of stuff too.
Like, you didn't cut me. Like, okay, well, go look in the mirror.
Yep.
Go look in the mirror. Like, you have no kidney on your one side. Your entire intestines are hanging out the front, and you never even noticed that. And in a hyped up situation, you might not notice it when it's a blade either. I had a friend that during putting a guy out of a bar, he got cut pretty bad on both hands. And it was a woman going completely batshit nuts, and she had a straight razor.
Oh,
he never felt it. Like, we had to wrap his hands up. He's like, I'm fine. Like, no, dude, look at your hands.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, one of the most valuable lessons I learned, we were doing some, like, you know, it was that 80%, you know, wrestling on the ground. We were in full kit. And all of a sudden, the instructor that was watching over us goes, freeze. So, you know, both of us are in the middle of wrestling on the ground. We both freeze, and he goes, show him. And I feel a tap, tap, tap on my kidneys. And I look back, and he had taken my knife out of my kit when we were wrestling, and was like, poking the back of my kidney with it. And it's like, if you have a weapon on you, it can be used against you if you're not aware of it. And that's another thing, like, just practicing, even if you're just going, like, you know, 20-30% with each other and just going, well, let's see if this worked. I remember learning some techniques about how to take somebody to the ground, and I got all excited about it. You know, I'd watched some videos on it, and I was like, hey man, let me practice this on you. And then I tried to do them in real life, and it's like, none of them worked the way I thought they were going to work. The first time I had to arrest a female that fought, and I think this was the only person I ever arrested that fought back, was she was drunk. And, you know, in the defensive tactics course they teach in the military or the police force, you know, we use arm bars to take people to the ground, right? Well, they kind of work most of the time if you get the right thing. If you have two of you, it works because one guy can distract and kind of hold the arm, and then you can use the leverage of the elbow. Well, I grabbed this woman's wrist, and I had, like, the perfect arm bar positioning and everything. And I got her wrist. I pulled it in. I had my hand on the back of her elbow, and I started pushing and driving her to the ground. And her elbow bent ways elbows aren't supposed to bend because she was drunk and a female, and she was just more limber and didn't shatter the elbow or anything, but it just didn't put her on the ground. Now, thankfully, she was small enough. I just grabbed her and threw her on the ground and then put handcuffs on her. But it was like, that was like my wake up call that this doesn't work in real life. Like, it's great when you're practicing it in a gym, but that's the first thing you learn in sparring too. So you learn all these techniques, right? You know, here's how you do this type of kick. Here's how you do this type of punch, whatever. And then you put the pads on and start hitting each other. And it's like, none of us are doing any of those things. We're just like moving around trying to see if we can land something on somebody. Yeah. And if you've been in those, even if it's just in a gym, at least you're learning, hey, you know what? This is going to be a lot messier if something goes down for real than it's looking when we're doing the technique on a pad or something like that.
You know, and I worked nightclub security for almost 2 years when I was younger, much younger. And I guess women are the worst. Women are the worst, like, because I think they expect that they're not going to get thrown on the ground or punched in the face or whatever. And dudes are like, you know what, there's more than one of them. They're doing some mental calculation where I think women are just expecting that it's always when they're really, really drunk or keyed, like in some cases keyed up on drugs. It's go crazy. And then there is a component of you that, like, I don't want to do this, right? And sometimes that's That can be a mistake too, but we'll leave that one because that's a whole different psychological.
Well, but you know, that brings up another point. I was in a years ago. I had to go to the store late at night at Walmart, and it was raining, and the parking lot was packed, and I was trying to find a parking space, and I drove around for like 10 minutes trying to find this parking space, and I finally get somebody backing out, and I pull in, and before I open my door, my car door just opens, and I look up, and it's this kid who's like all pissed off because, quote unquote, I took his parking place, and you know they're in the same situation trying to find a parking place to go in. And instead of just slamming my door closed, I made the mistake of standing up. Now I'm trapped in the corner between the door and the vehicle, and we end up in a fight, and I have him on the ground, and I have both my thumbs on his eyes. And, you know, in my head, I'd gone through lots of, you know, hey, if this happens, you know, if it's life and death, blah, blah, blah,
yeah,
then you can kill somebody this way. And right as I started to put pressure on his eyes, my head was like, I don't think I should kill this guy right now. And so I let go of him, and then he punched me and ran away. So yeah, it's like, and we were both beat up in the situation.
Yeah.
You plan for these things, and it's like, but do you really have the justification? I'm glad that I didn't do it now, because I probably would be in prison for murder.
Yeah.
That didn't justify that level of response, but you have to be careful how you plan through these things, because either you don't want to go too light and end up getting seriously hurt yourself, but you also don't want to go too hard in a situation like that and end up killing someone when all they were doing was, you know, a normal fist fight. He didn't have any weapons or anything like that. But that situation happened so fast, and it was like a year or two after I started getting into dogs, so I had a protection dog at home. And, of course, what did I do? I didn't bring her with me because I was in a hurry to run to the store. And if she had been there, the fight would have never happened in the first place. As soon as that door opened, she would have started barking and lunging at him, and he would have run off, and situation would have never happened. But all of those things are things that are just worth people thinking through and understanding it when you are considering what would happen and what would I do in these situations.
So the visual component of the dog alone, especially a dog that looks and acts a certain way, is very, very strong. But the dog is just a tool, like a gun, like a knife. And I am big on, you know, if you can be armed, be armed. I think that that is a responsible thing to do as a citizen. Some people can't for various reasons where they live or different situations, but if you can, do so. But I never want somebody to think, because I have a gun, I have nothing to worry about. Like, one of the things that you have a gun, okay, great. That means that potentially the adversary you're dealing with has a gun, right? There's going to be a gun in the fight because you brought one. There's going to be a knife in the fight because you brought one. About the only time I really think you don't have to worry about the weapon you brought coming at you is you have a well-trained dog in the fight. The dog can make a decision. All these other things are inanimate objects, even if they're not weapons. A security system is just something that makes a noise, right, and tells police to come write a report after the incident's over, because when they get there, the incident's over. So none of these tools are a system without an operator to put them into play. So how do people think about the right way to consider having these tools without creating false confidence?
So the idea with the system is you get your mindset right, you decide what tools you can afford and that are going to be effective for your particular area. And like I said, the alarms and the cameras and all that, those are all good things. I'm not saying don't have stuff like that, especially if you can afford it and it fits into your, you know, your plan. But each of those things has a purpose to it, right? And you have to understand the purpose of each tool, and then you stack as many of those things in your favor as you can. So the gun is great, but there are situations where you may not want to use a gun. One example that, you know, I'm not saying you wouldn't want to use a gun in a home invasion situation. You probably would. But like you had mentioned earlier, most houses are set up where the master bedroom and bath are on one side of the house so mom and dad can have privacy. And then all the rest of the bedrooms are on the other side of the house with the living room, kitchen, and stuff in the middle. Well, if you hear a noise and you get up in the middle of the night and you walk into a living room and there's a bad guy standing there with a baseball bat and you start shooting at him, rounds go through drywall. So you have to know who's on the other side of that. And your children have to know, what do I do if I start hearing noise or gunshots or anything like that in the middle of the night? And children need to be, like I used to train my kids, roll off the bed and roll under the bed. So if you're doing what you're supposed to, I can be reasonably confident that if I keep the rounds at chest level and above, even if I'm going through walls, I'm not going to be hitting my children. But you have to consider all of those things when you're going through this. And so the system involves, you know, running through these scenarios in your head at least. And then when you do your walkthroughs in your house, it's okay. If I'm standing here, this is my starting point. Like you said, when is the home invasion happening, right? If it's at night when we're sleeping, my starting point is the bedroom. If it's in the evening when I'm watching TV, my starting point's probably on the couch watching TV. If the starting point is first thing in the morning, I might be in the kitchen making breakfast. And so you have to go from each starting point and at least be aware of, if I had to shoot in this direction, what's over there? What's behind the person? Because that 1 in 5 is a real statistic that there's a high probability you're going to miss some of your rounds, especially when the person starts moving. And the other thing people tend to do, I had this experience when I was hunting a deer one time. It was either the first or second time I took my sons with me. They were maybe 6 years old, 6 or 8. And so we're sitting out there, you know, just leaning against a tree, waiting. Hopefully a deer is going to walk by. Sure enough, this doe comes walking by, and I'm tracking her with my rifle scope. And she's walking, and I'm waiting for a clear shot through the brush so that I don't have a bunch of bushes I'm trying to shoot through. And she finally gets to a clear spot all the way over on the side. I pull the trigger, and she goes down. But once I looked up, the rifle barrel was right next to my son's head. And, you know, everybody was fine. Nothing bad happened. But I was like, holy crap. Like, I was completely unaware of what was right there to my side because I was excited about getting this animal. And you get that tunnel vision. And not only the tunnel vision, but you're just not thinking, right? Yeah. You get your thought process narrows
your on tunnel thinking.
The thing.
Your tunnel thinking, not just tunnel seeing. That's definitely, definitely a thing. I think the tools are good for some level of confidence, but false confidence is always a danger. Like, you have to understand, I think we have to understand this, all things can still go wrong.
Right? Yes.
Like, that can still not work out. Because if you don't understand that, when they inevitably do, then your time lag to compensate is worse, and there's more opportunity for things to go wrong from the other end. And, like, we always have these scenarios in our head, and, like, who said it was one person that broke into your house?
Exactly.
Who said it was one person that confronted you in the parking lot? It might, like, if two people come in your house, you might be able to kind of discern that pretty quick. But if I'm working with you and we're the bad guys, what's going to happen is, like, you're going to be the guy that goes out in front of them and says, hey, man, I need some gas money to get home or whatever.
And I'm going to come up behind them.
Yep. And so that second party there, the minute, like, he says, well, I can handle this bearded fuck, and he goes to task with you, and I'm standing behind him with a screwdriver.
Yep.
Right? And there's your kidneys, right? Do you want your other kidney? Now give him what he asked for. And I think the problem is because most people just don't think this way, and I don't mean, like, the scenario we're talking about. I'm thinking you and I do not think about hurting another person that way unless we're running a scenario. Because of that, the idea that somebody would actually do that to you, even though you intellectually know it, emotionally you repel it, right? Like, people aren't that evil. Like, you watch a TV show, and, like, some of the shit you see in TV, you're like, wow, that's really dark. Nobody would really do that, unless it's like a horror movie or something where it's, like, supernatural. Right. Like, actually, it's way worse than that.
Oh, yeah.
Actually, it's way worse. Some of the things that have happened, like, this asshole that they just put in, well, he's probably going to get the needle. The one that killed the little girl who was a contractor for UPS, it happened just a few miles from my home. Like, as bad as we thought it was, when it went to trial, I don't even want to say it, but the things that that person did to that child, skin crawling level, like, I'm going to say he probably won't get the needle, because I have a feeling the old honor among thieves thing, if he turns his back one time the wrong way, he's just going to disappear. Like, he's going to be a skid mark in the underpants of society and gone, and I won't cry for him. But if one person will do that, then other people will do that too.
Yep.
And you have to understand how vicious this can be.
Well, Jordan Peterson talked about PTSD quite a bit. And one of the things he pointed out is most people who are actually traumatized are not traumatized because something bad happened to them. They're traumatized because their eyes were open to either how bad they can be, like they were in a situation where they did something to somebody else and then they couldn't believe that they were capable of doing that, or when somebody else did something that was so horrific to them that it's like, I thought humanity was better than this, or I didn't think humanity could get that bad, or I didn't think I could be that bad. And when people are in a world where morality is questionable or fungible or whatever in their brains, the levels that they will go to do bad things are worse than you could possibly imagine. And most people don't want to think about it. When I was getting ready to go down range, I used to watch the beheading videos of the Muslims that would capture people and then cut their heads off on video, just so I would be like, that's who we're fighting.
Yeah.
You got to be ready for that level. Like, save a round for yourself for the worst case situation, because I'm not going to end up being that guy right there.
Yeah.
But when you start to get into that, it's like you don't want to look at it. Like, the first couple of times I watched those videos, like, I couldn't sleep at night for the first couple of nights, because it was, you just see it in your head, and there's a trauma that goes along with that, and people don't want to expose themselves to that. But then when something really bad goes on, they're like, oh crap, I was totally unprepared for this, because I wasn't willing to take a look at that.
Yeah. Can we talk you are the dog guy, so how do protection dogs fit into this in a real world way, and how are they like a force multiplier?
So protection dogs do a couple of things for you. Number one, they bring a deterrence factor. Like, even if you have a dog that's mildly obedient, that, you know, it looks like you've got decent control of it, and it's a fairly intimidating looking dog, there's a high level of deterrence there, even if the dog never has to bite anybody or isn't trained to bite. And so there's a benefit to having just that. But if I always describe it as, it's like carrying a gun with no bullets. So you can draw a gun and point it at somebody in a parking lot who's threatening you, and they might run away. But if they're like, you're not going to pull that trigger, and they start walking toward you, and you squeeze the trigger, and all you have is a click, it's like you're in a bad situation now. So there's the deterrent factor of the dog. But then what the dog does is it buys you time, it gives you distance, and if you're fighting alongside the dog, it is a huge distraction to the person. So we would run drills where we actually filmed these years ago. I need to find these videos where we had a guy that was walking and just walking by himself. I had a training knife. I walked up to him and I was like, hey man, you got any money? Blah, blah, blah. And he's like, no, I don't have anything. And I'm like, fuck you. And I ran towards him and I just start slashing and stabbing at him with the knife. And this dude was a Navy SEAL. He's like, knew how to fight, knew how to do everything else. I would get 6 or 8 slashes and stabs before he could take the knife from me.
Yeah.
And then we did one with the dog, and first of all, as soon as the dog turned around and sees an aggressive posture on a person that's been trained to bite, and it engages, it hits my arm that doesn't have the knife, and I turn to go stab the dog, and we train our dogs to counter this anyway, when the person is in the fight with them, as soon as I would go to start stabbing the dog, he grabs my arm, because now I'm not after him, I'm after the dog, so it's not targeting him, so it's easier to get a hold of it, and it's not, you know, it's not like in the movies where it's like, oh, I have the perfect grip, and I'm going to do this, and then twist the knife and take it out of your hands. It's
I got the G.I. Joe Kung Fu grip, baby. You know,
exactly. Like, but he still got a hold of my arm, and then he's able to manipulate to a point where he can get it. He pushes me into the vehicle. The dog's still fighting my other arm, so I can't use that against him. And now he can take the knife away. So that it's like having 2 or 3 guys with you fighting alongside you if you have your dog there. So you have the deterrence. The time is, I always say, if you're in a home invasion scenario, this is one of the best places to see it. So most people think, especially they get into firearms, they start carrying concealed. They're like, I'm going to be, you know, have my gun on me all the time. And the first couple of months, they come home from, you know, work or whatever, and they keep their knife on them, their gun. They sit down and watch TV with the family. And after about 6 months of that, because you're all dedicated in the beginning, right? You're like, this thing's really uncomfortable. I'm sitting on the couch trying to relax. So maybe I'm going to put it in the bedroom, you know, in the dresser drawer and actually relax with my family. And so you start off thinking, I'm going to have this tool. Well, now it's uncomfortable. I'm going to put it over here because we don't want to set it on the table where the kids can get it or whatever. And if somebody kicks your door, and then what do you need? You need time to be able to go get that gun, right? Yeah. Wherever that gun is, if it's in the bedroom or, you know, in a drawer, in a book, you know, a hollow book on the shelf, whatever it is where you keep your stuff, you've got to be able to get to it. So people that are doing home invasions, it's like an ambush. They rely on speed and intensity, and they typically try to get in and get everybody under control as quickly as possible. Then they can close the door, and it looks like the house is just normal. And but if you can get time to get to a weapon, or even just time to run out the back door and be able to call the cops from the neighbor's house, but time is a key component of defending yourself. And the dog engaging with somebody gives you time to run away. And again, like I said earlier, there's never a one-size-fits-all in a fight, right? If it's me by myself or me in my home and there's a home invasion, I'm going into the fight with the dog as much as I can. But what if it's me in a parking lot with my kid? Well, I'd rather grab my kid and run, let the dog engage that threat, create distance, and then call them to me from a distance. And so you get the time, you get the distance. They're causing injury and pain to the person. And they also allow you to take control of a situation. So one of the things we teach all of our clients is when you have your dog with you, you control your space. And for my training with my clients is your space is about 6 feet around you, about the length of your dog lead that you have, right? And I can control my space a couple of different ways. If a bad guy is approaching, like somebody who's really suspicious, right? I don't know that they're a true threat yet, but I don't want them coming any closer to me. I can use my dog and I can say, stay back. Don't come any closer. You're going to get bit. I put my dog on watch and they start barking and the person's like, whoa, the dog's actually showing aggression toward
me.
Now, if that person keeps walking in, well, they get what they get. Now, if they stay back at a distance and draw a weapon, what can I do? I can just let go of the lead of my dog and they run in and start engaging. And if they try to turn that weapon on the dog, now I can draw my weapon and we've got all these different opportunities that I have now that I didn't have before when I didn't have the dog there with me. And so you go through all of these things and it's you want the time, you want the opportunity, you want the distance. And now I can use my other tools. The other thing that a dog brings, I've had a lot of female clients who are not, they don't have any problem with firearms, but they'll just tell me straight up, they're like, I go to the range with my husband, I shoot, I carry a gun, but I don't think I could actually pull the trigger on somebody.
Yeah, that's
an important thing to understand about yourself, because some people carry guns, and just like I had my fingers on those eyeballs, and thankfully I didn't push in and kill the dude. But a lot of people will either hesitate to draw a gun because they're not sure that they have the justification to do it, or they'll draw the gun and they'll hesitate to pull the trigger. And then that person closes the distance and takes that weapon away from you. Once a dog engages, first of all, people are a lot less hesitant to engage with a dog because it's probably not going to be deadly, right? In theory, a dog could kill a person. If you have multiple dogs and they're just left to fight a person, they're probably going to die. But if it's one person versus one dog, the dog's almost certainly not going to kill the person. Now, of course, you know, it is possible, but probably not. So and I can call the dog out immediately. So the dog goes in and engages. Most people, if you have a dog and they still target you, number one, they're a much higher risk. Number two, a lot of those people are probably thinking, yeah, that's a dog, but I've scared dogs off before. That dog's probably not going to do anything. Once the dog actually goes in and starts ripping their arms apart, they're like, oh, crap, I didn't think this was going to happen. Now I just want it to end. Well, I can deploy a dog in. They can hit one or two bites, and then the person's like, ah, get him off, get him off. And let's go. Now I bring the dog back to me. I'm not injuring him anymore, right? But now I can take control of the situation in a way where I might say, get on the ground. If you move again, you'll be bit. Do you understand me? Do not move. Put your arms out to the side. Turn your head the other way so you can't see me.
Yeah.
And I can control the situation that way. Or I can take my space and I can physically walk in a direction and move my space to another space. So I use that analogy where I was in an airport and this kid came up and, you know, he was retarded, not in the like a retard way. He was like genuinely had mental issues.
80s retarded. He was 80s retarded.
But he was super nice. He came up and he asked if he could pet the dog. And I was like, sure, you can pet the dog. Well, he sits on the floor next to the dog and he starts petting it. And then he kind of starts laying on the dog and just a little too much, right? And at first I was like, okay, you know, let's not do that, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And he just wasn't listening to me. So what did I do? I said, well, buddy, I got to go get on my flight now. And I grabbed my backpack and I said, come on, foos up with my dog. And we walked away. So I didn't like what was happening in my space. So I moved my space
moved out of another area.
And so when you control your space around you, you can use the dog to do that. I can use it at a distance if I had to send my dog and then I recalled them. Now, I always say if you're in a parking lot, and somebody attacks you, you use your dog, and then you call your dog back to you, and they run away, don't deploy your dog on them again. Like, you have to think about the fight after the fight, the legal fight. Mm-hmm. And you're fully justified to use the dog if you're justified to use a firearm. And I generally recommend that's when you know, I can warn you with a watch, but I'm only going to release the dog to bite you if I see a weapon come out. And if there's a weapon, I can use a firearm. And but if somebody's in your home, you may not want them to run out of the home at 3 a.m. after they just kicked your front door in. I might want to make sure you stay there until the police come, because you could go out, regroup, and come back.
Yeah.
Right? My door's already damaged, that sort of thing. But all of this is I have options now that I didn't have before. And if you have a gun, all you can do is shoot somebody. You can point it at them and not shoot, but in public, if you draw a gun and point it at somebody, in most states, that's considered the same thing as actually firing it, in terms of if you didn't have the justification to shoot it, you didn't have the justification to pull it.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, whereas if I have a dog with me, my dog can bark at somebody and I'm not going to jail for it.
Yeah, yeah. I also would tell you that I have seen instances where people have been shot and had, like we talked earlier, almost no reaction initially.
Yep.
I have seen people get cut, and I've seen that in real time, real life, more than once, and have almost no reaction, especially a very sharp knife. It does a lot of damage. I'm not saying that it can't be extremely lethal. I'm saying that there's not a lot of like instant pain unless a certain place is hit, like a certain nerve, or like when blade hits bone, after it hurts. But I have never seen anybody bit by a dog
and not react. Yep.
And I mean, even a little yappy, just one quick, like a defensive trigger bite, not really a grab on it, because the teeth are they're not designed to cut.
Right.
They're designed to rip, tear, and hold the canine ancestry of a predator, right? If you're a prey animal, you're going to be preyed upon, you're probably much better off having a lion break your neck in half a second than being run down by a pack of wolves. It is a nasty way to go down, right? That's why, like, I think that's part of, like, the whole eaten by dogs in the streets is in the Bible, because it is viscerally a nasty way to go. So there is something about that dog. You've said you had guys that have been in firefights and shit, and they walk by one of your dogs, and they're just a little afraid. They're not afraid to get shot at.
Right.
Or they're afraid of the dog. There is a innate primal thing in those type of teeth and human flesh that has a psychological effect, but the physical effect, you've been, you know, had wardrobe malfunctions in a bite suit, and I've seen some marks on you, you've been bit, it freaking hurts.
Yep.
It hurts enough to get a response. And maybe if you're messed up or on PCP or something, but in general, when the teeth go in, that the focus goes there, and the big thing to that is, you're still there.
Right.
And the minute you take your eyes off me, now I have visual superiority in the situation. You're occupied. I can deal with that knife hand, or I can deal with whatever else you're doing a hell of a lot better than I can alone.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that kind of gets into a little bit of, you know, obviously, just like going to a MMA ring and learning to take a couple punches, learning to swing and use your fists as punches is going to put you in a lot better situation than somebody who's never done any of that if you do end up in a fight. But being in a ring where there's rules and being on the street where there's not are two totally different things. A dog that has been trained to bite in like a sport ring or something like that, they're better than nothing for sure. But you know, most of the videos you find online and stuff, the dog comes in and bites, and then what do? They have a stick, they call it a rattle stick, and they start smacking the dog with the rattle stick. Now, they do that to teach to put the dog under pressure to see if it's going to stay in the fight, and it does put the dog under pressure. What it's also doing simultaneously, though, is it's training the dog not to respond to a weapon. So just like if you go to a range and, you know, there was this old adage of when the guys were shooting the revolvers, frequently those police officers would get shot in the tops of the head. And what would happen is they would shoot their six rounds, and then when they opened the cylinder, they would look down, they would catch the rounds in their hand, they would put them in their pocket, and while they're doing all that, the other person is still shooting at them. Why were they doing that under stress? Because in the range, over and over and over again, we don't want to pick up brass. So don't drop your rounds on the ground. Put them in your hand and keep them in your pocket, and we'll empty your pockets at the end. So if you train yourself where you have things like that, the range things that you're training, those things are going to – you're training your subconscious when you're doing that. And so if the dog's been trained only to bite and hold, that's better than nothing, and most people don't want it. But if the person has a knife, now that dog is basically stationary. If they bite a bicep or a forearm and they're staying there, I can throw a knife and just start stabbing that dog. And it doesn't mean that in a real fight, even a dog that's been trained to counter can't get hurt, because in fights you get hurt. That is what happens. And so you should expect that people and probably the dog at some point are going to get hurt. But if I deploy a dog in and somebody's got a weapon of some kind, what are they not using that weapon on? Me. Even if they're focusing it on the dog. So what can I do? If I have weapons, I can draw them and use them. Yeah. And, you know, people will say things like, well, your dog will just get shot. Well, dogs are easy to shoot if they're on a chain or a tie out. You know, the ATF does it all the time, right? When they go get ready to go in for a drug bust or whatever. But if a dog is running loose and it can move and it can dodge, and a lot of times they kind of do this sweeping flank, right, when they come in. And when that kind of stuff is happening, number one, dogs are half our size or less, and they're twice as fast. It's hard to hit a moving target. But if the person's attention is on the dog, it's not on me. Either get to safety, I can go in, I can draw my own tools, my gun or my knife or whatever it is I have on me, and I can use that. And like you said, the guy who did that was a tier one operator. He'd been in the teams for like 12 years. So I don't know how many missions he'd been on, but I know he'd kill a lot of guys. And he walked into the room, and all my dog did, she was laying on a table, and all she did was just sit up and look at him. Like, it was just like, I'm asleep. Oh, somebody's walking in the door. Sit up and pay attention to who it is. And he had that flinch reaction because he knew all the dogs there had been trained to bite, and it was his first time there training. And it was just that, I don't want to be bit. You know, he could probably have killed every other guy in the room if he wanted to. But that dog was that, I don't want that to happen.
Well, let's talk a bit about your company here as we wrap up. I'll talk about your book here in a second, but you do run Fortress Canine. Tell folks about Fortress Canine and what it's all about and what makes it different than other places where they might find protection dogs.
So the big thing with us is we train dogs that are safe to be with your family, safe to take in public. If you've ever been to any of my events, we bring dogs with us and people, you know, we bring them out and people pet on them and love on them and all that kind of stuff. But they're also capable in the fight. So our focus is we want dogs that are good with a family, but that are also capable of defending you if the worst should happen. Some of the stuff we were talking about with the sport fighting, our dogs are trained from the very beginning to fight a human being. So we're not just biting, we're countering a human and we're fighting with that human. So if the guy is hitting your dog, the dog reverses and counters the other arm. If they draw a weapon, the dog reverses. We call it reversing. They let go of the bite and they retarget where they're biting at, right? We train our dogs on multiple attackers. We run them through scenarios like home invasions, attacks in and around your vehicle, and surprise attacks on yourself. And so our goal is, if you could only have one tool that would give you the greatest capability of defending yourself, what could we create? And it's the protection dog.
Yeah. And his dogs are great. Just for those that are on the video, that's actually my dog, Belle, right there, and my granddaughter.
Yep.
She's not a Malinois or a Shepherd. I told Tegan, that's my granddaughter for everybody that didn't see it. I told her she's either a Shepherd Noir or a Malinois Shepherd, and Tegan decided she's a Malinois Shepherd, so that's what she is. And if you like all those pictures and you want to learn more about this, Joel has a book called Beyond the Bite that just recently came out. It is available on both FortressCanine.com and Canine Academy. .us where he does training for the people to train the dogs virtually. And Joel, you want to tell them about this book?
Absolutely. So Beyond the Bite is where we go into all the details of how we do things differently than the sport world. So I always tell people I have no problem with people who want to do sports with their dogs, but just like doing Taekwondo is not actually learning how to defend yourself in a street fight, doing sport biting with a dog is not the same as them protecting you in real life. And so we go into how do the dogs bite, the bite mechanics, why our dogs bite hands and forearms, why we don't do the full mouth bite versus the driving in versus the thrashing and pulling out. All of those details are in there. It's got tons and tons of great pictures. I think at least every page has some picture on it in the book, so it's designed to be very visual. But it also has all the information in there in terms of if you're interested in getting a protection dog or just learning about protection dogs and how they're different from sport dogs, this is an awesome book. It was written to educate people on the difference between sport dogs, law enforcement dogs, and protection dogs.
I think one of my favorite parts in there is where you talk about breed standards and how they've screwed things up.
Yeah.
And you show what the standard of a German Shepherd was 100 years ago. And the standard of what is considered a perfect German Shepherd now with the sweeping back and everything. And then you show the profile of your dogs versus the original standard. And yeah. I think that's really interesting because people say that purebred dogs, and I know you believe in doing some cross breeding and some hybridization right. here and there. Even though mine is crossbred, but it was not intentional. That was a girl that decided she wanted puppies when she was supposed to be rested. We'll just leave it at that. That jailbroke and went out and made puppies. But the people say the purebreds have all these problems. I don't think purebreds have problems. I think our desire to breed what we want
right.
created problems. Joint problems, German Shepherds, hips, things that, I think. You know, and or they're just really, mine was so huge. I was surprised he didn't have more joint issues by the time he got older.
Yeah, and that's another breed. Americans always want things big, right?
Big,
so in America, we've bred these German Shepherds that are 100-plus pounds. And some of those can be healthy, but any big dog is going to have more joint problems than the smaller dogs. Most of our dogs, our females will get as light as 45 pounds up to 65, and we occasionally get a 75-pound female. And most of our males are in the 55 on the really, really small side up to about 90 pounds. And with the average being for the males about 75 pounds and for the females about 60 pounds. And then, you said, it's not the quote-unquote – well, first of all, there's not really any such thing as purebred because everything was created from something if you go back far enough.
Yeah.
But you can narrow the genetics up to create a breed, which – originally they were all designed to do a task. And what we started doing is instead of saying, can this German Shepherd actually go out and work with the shepherd? We started saying, we want them to do this and this, or we want them to look a certain way. And so then the look becomes the standard instead of the work becoming the standard. And over time, you have to be careful not to narrow the genetic pool to such a degree that the problems that are inherent in any gene pool become dominant, right, in those gene pools. So if you have two dogs and one has the genetics for a hip problem and the other doesn't, most genetic problems, I'd say 95% of genetic problems are recessive genes. So they only show up when you get recessive and recessive. So when you have a dog that's strong and doesn't have that problem and a dog that might have it, as long as the one doesn't, and it's got a dominant and a recessive, the dominant shows up and you don't have the hip problem. Mm. It's when you narrow the gene pool too much and you have too many recessive problems in the gene pool, you start getting, even in a litter, you might get one healthy dog and then six unhealthy dogs in the AKC breeding process.
Versus completely the opposite being more likely. The heterozygous traits are what you're talking about there, and they both have to be present to be expressed. Yeah,
right.
That makes a lot of sense. Let's take a couple questions real quick, and then I'll let you go because we're over an hour and a half here. This one I find interesting. I'm your Huckleberry says, first rule of gunfight is have a gun. Do both of you carry at home consistently? Do other family members, do you always carry a TQ? I guess he means tourniquet or have one available. I would tell you that most of the time, if you see me somewhere, I probably am armed. Most of the time in the house, I'm probably armed. But there's points if I'm in my drawers watching TV at 8:30 with my wife on the couch, I'm probably not armed, but I am probably steps away from a gun. And I don't want to say any more than that because it starts to give away things that you'd prefer not to give away. But there's places you can't carry and you need to have other tools available. There's places you could carry, but maybe I recently went to Colorado. We spent 90% of our time in Estes Park. Estes Park is the kind of place that they put merchandise out in the street and don't worry about anybody stealing it. It's unlikely. And then the hassle of packing a second lock back. So I didn't carry when I was there. So that would be an instance of when I'm not armed. Other family members, in my particular instance, no, I can't get that across I don't want somebody that doesn't want to carry. Let me put it that way.
Right.
Right. I want to encourage everybody to do it, but I don't want anybody to do it that doesn't want to do it. So it's always a big, it depends. As far as carrying a tourniquet, probably not as often as I should.
Yeah.
Probably not. But I promise you, if somebody needs a circulation cutoff because they're going to bleed out, I will find something
Yep.
I will find something. I wear a belt everywhere I go that will work as a tourniquet.
Knees are really effective at stopping blood flow too.
What's that?
Put your knee on somebody if they.
Oh yeah.
If it's a low femoral artery cut, you roll them on their side and drop your knee on that on the inside of their thigh. You'll stop the bleeding. You have to stay there until somebody comes to put a tourniquet on or the ambulance arrives, but you'll stop the blood flow.
I it was not a gun incident. It was an auto accident, but I've literally physically clamped a blood vessel with my hands.
Yep.
Until somebody got there, and it probably saved a dude's life.
Yep.
Yeah.
What I try to do with medical stuff is I try to have a medical kit in each vehicle, and then we have multiples around the house, both for in case there's a dog bite somewhere, but you know they've got tourniquets and stuff like that in them as well. So I don't necessarily think you have to always carry medical stuff on your body, although I know plenty of guys who do that. It's just too bulky for me. I don't like having all that bulk. But it's like I'm never more than a one-minute run from my vehicle. Now, of course, you know, somebody can bleed out in less time than that. But if it's nearby, I can get to it and I can use it. For people who don't know my background, I do have a felony. It's a nonviolent felony, so I can't carry right now. But I'm in the process of getting my my gun rights restored. So the Trump administration, for as many bad things as they've done, they've opened up for anyone with nonviolent felonies to be able to restore their gun rights because it's like we didn't hurt anybody and we weren't going to. So so once that, you know, if I had the ability to, I definitely do.
They could be a little self-serving for somebody, Orange. I didn't really think of it until you just said it. And I don't have a problem with that either, by the way. I'm just saying, like, it, sometimes it's good for politicians to face things that other people do because then maybe they get a little, oh, now I care about it. Like, have you ever noticed that, this is totally unrelated, but any celebrity that has a that champions a cause for, like, a rare disease has that disease or, like, their kid does. It's never, like, out of a shirt, like, oh, I learned about this thing, and now I want other people to know. So maybe that's good, but, yeah. Next question from Hunter says, can I have only one dog trained? I have three. One is young and shows intelligent aggression, whatever he means by that. The other two are walking rugs. I'll let you answer for yourself. My answer would be, well, make sure you know what training really is, and you talk to people like Joel on that. But I don't see any reason that wouldn't be the case, except that you may want to at least have enough you need to think about this differently from a standpoint of if that dog's not locked on 100% trained, dogs will turn on each other, especially if they've never worked together. So it's not that your rug mat dog is really a problem, but if they get keyed up too and they do engage, so I've seen dogs turn on other dogs in stressful situations, especially if they can't get at the real threat. Like it's something like this. And my dog Charlie had issues with that one time. He flipped out on Lucy because a huge thundercrack hit. Mm-hmm. And I mean, one of those ones that there's no lightning, there's no nothing. It just hits and like the windows reverberate and he just flat out. And I had to yank him off her because he just I got to dump it somewhere. So like you got to use caution there. But I don't see why you can't train one dog.
Well, the if you have multiple dogs, even if they've not been trained to bite, that is a like Nicole Sauce had that issue where she's got dogs that they have to be careful of being around each other. So my thing is, you know, just in general, being a dog owner is you should have some decent level of foundational obedience in that dog so that it can, be well-mannered and live in your life. We sell tons of dogs to people who already have dogs. A lot of them have like little yippy dogs or a lot of them have other like mid-sized dogs. The cat just walked by the dogs. Yeah. And what I tell people is the main thing is, number one, you maintain the obedience and discipline. If you train a dog to be a protection dog, you need to have more control over that dog. We don't do any protection training with people who don't have solid obedience already in their dogs. So sometimes if they want a protection dog that they've already got and they're coming to us to train, the first thing we do is obedience. You've got to have control of that dog first before we teach you to bite. But once you have control of the dog is you just have to be fair to the protection dog. So if you have little yippy dogs, and they're going to come mess with the dog. They don't have to be obedient, but they have to be good-natured with the dog, right? If you have medium-sized dogs, they can't come up and like be all over your dog and all that kind of stuff while your dog's being, you know, obedient and laying in its place and doing what it's supposed to. So now, in terms of having multiple protection dogs, I have a section in the book about one dog is protection, two dogs are an army, and three dogs are unstoppable. If you've got two or three dogs attacking somebody, they're way more. Now, if you have three dogs, they they can turn into a kill team very easily. Three dogs, one will often start targeting legs or ankles, and once you're pulled off balance and go to ground, they tend to go groin, abdomen, neck. So when we do muzzle work with the dogs where we're falling on the ground, they do that very frequently. So multiple protection dogs definitely increase your capability. But yeah, as long as you have good obedience in your dog and you maintain their discipline, having multiple dogs where one of them is a protection dog and the others are just pets works out just fine.
Yeah. Yeah. And the key is, and this is something I've seen a lot of places not do well. And I'm judging them by their own videos, right? I'm not judging them on what Joel says. But I watch these videos, especially ones that are more bred for like the sporting bite and hold.
Right.
And they'll do their thing, and then they'll call the dog off, and they'll end up having to pull the dog off.
Mm-hmm.
Or they'll have to give that command multiple times, and that dog doesn't release. If you have multiple dogs and you have a dog trained the way Joel trains them, well, when you call that dog out, that dog is – like, I've seen you have to say it a second time because they can't hear you because it's all, you know,
right,
loud. But once they hear that call, they're out. And that dog goes right back to chill mode. And, you know, I've told you that. Like, my pit mix, Charlie, my big mistake was he didn't have an off switch.
Right.
And it scared me from ever training a dog to be that aggressive towards certain things. I didn't have him trained the way that you do. I had him trained like, you don't get in that freaking gate unless I open that thing and I let you in.
Right.
He was full wired for that, and it was kind of scary at times. And you know, you try to teach it later, and I think you'd agree. Get that the training needs to be simultaneous.
Yes.
Like, we might take him to advanced skills, but the core training, the fact that you bite, okay, well, now we got that. Now we got to get a release, and we don't go to this next level until you master that, right? Like, that's your white belt. Right.
Yeah, and we call it stability in the dogs.
Yeah.
So essentially, when they're young, it's just building the bite and building the confidence of the dog to engage and to fight with the bite. But as soon as their confidence is moderately good, we start doing stability training. So I'll wear equipment and I'll walk up to the dog like I'm going to engage with it. But the handler says, leave it alone, it's okay. Now, when you first start to do this, they fail. They lunge out and they bite the sleeve.
Yeah.
But we correct them, we put them back, and we'll walk around these dogs. We'll actually bump them with the equipment, and I'll agitate them. And if their handler says, leave it alone, they leave it alone. There's only one time the dog's allowed to break obedience and engage in a fight, and if the person physically goes hands-on with their handler. They don't need a command in that situation.
Yeah.
Other
than
that, the dogs... they only bite when they're told to bite or when somebody attacks their handler. And so that's stability, but it starts, like you were saying, Jack, when they're little pups. It's like the first thing we teach our Malinois and Dutch Shepherd puppies to do is get on a table, lay down, and relax.
And don't move.
And you have about that first year to teach them that, and if you don't, they'll never be able to calm into a setting. And the sport dogs are often what happens with most protection companies is somebody breeds the dog, somebody else does the green dog training where they might introduce some basic commands, and then somebody else trains it for the sport, and then a protection company goes to these sport competitions, and they go, I want that dog, and that dog, and they'll go up and try and buy those dogs off those people, and then they finish them up, and then they sell them as a protection dog. And so that's why I use sports references when we're doing our contrast, because most quote-unquote protection dogs are trained with the sport technique. Well, what happens in the sports is it's a lot faster and easier to teach these dogs to do the sport things if you have them crazy over a toy of some kind, a tug, some kind of a you know, a Kong or a tug of some kind, and they'll do anything for this toy. But the thing is, if you don't have the toy, you don't have any control over them. And the other thing is, they don't settle. Most of these dogs live in kennels, because they can't come into a house and lay down and relax. And if they do bring them into a house, like a single person, and the dog just runs all around the house all day, and they're just like, well, that's just my dog. I got to deal with it. And so our goal is to have dogs that can live comfortably in your home. They're not going to eat your couch. They're not going to knock your kids over. And they'll chill and relax.
Yeah, yeah. Well, some of the best things you taught me in dealing with the high energy of like a dog with Malinois genetics, which is like meth and ecstasy and speed infused into the DNA, was one, she drug a leash for 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
She had a leash on at all times. If it got out of hand, step on the leash, you just You just chose your own corrective action and how much of it you're going to get. Two, though, was that sitting and watching was a job.
Yes.
I'm like, this dog needs a job. And it's not necessarily you can't wear them out physically. You can take them out and you can run them and you can push them till that tongue is touching dirt and give them 15 minutes.
Yep, and they're ready to go again.
Right? Like, so, but when you, but what they really need is not, so they need physical activity, but it's not all they need. They need a purpose. These are dogs that were bred with a purpose. They were a herding dog. They have a purpose. But herding dogs don't herd all the time. They watch and they herd when they need to. Once I understood that from you and we gave her the job, she likes the corner of the couch. She perches up there. She watches out the window. That's her job. And now that's what she does. And when we go to bed, she'll come in, she'll get a pet. She goes back out and she perches on the couch at the door entrance.
Yep.
That's a job. And so since she has a job, she's at the, you know, dog peace, right? If dogs have Buddhism, I don't know, but it's kind of like that's their Zen state. Like, I'm doing my thing. And because I'm doing my thing, it's okay. And I can be at peace. But if they have nothing to do, then they're bored. And then they eat your couch or, you know, when you have a workshop and they go upstairs, they eat the carpet like she did. Right?
Well, and the other thing that happens a lot of times is if your dog's given, my recommendation to clients is always your dog should be in obedience all the time. And even when they're quote unquote free, like if I take them out to use the bathroom and I go, all right, you're free, go get busy. I told them they're free. And at any point I should be able to go, let's go. And they break out of that and come running right back to me. And so I want my dogs under obedience at all times. But a lot of people misunderstand that and think, oh, well, the dog doesn't get to be a dog or it doesn't get to have fun or whatever. First of all, we pet our dogs all the time. So they're always excited when we walk up and give them scratches behind the ears and all that. But they're way more confident when they're in obedience all the time, because when you give them too much freedom, they do things that you don't want them to do, but they're only caught doing the things you don't want them to do maybe every third time they do it, right? So they do a thing, and it could just be going to the trash can in the kitchen and sniffing at it. Maybe they don't even take anything out of it, but you don't want them in there sniffing at it, because if I throw chicken wings in there, I don't want you to eat them and have to go get surgery, right?
Yeah.
And so they're in doing something, and then one day you walk in and yell at them for doing it, and what ends up happening with the dogs is they end up in this, like, am I allowed to do this time, or am I going to get in trouble? I don't know.
And so
their whole mannerism is, I'm not sure if I'm doing what I'm supposed to. I kind of get away with this sometimes, and I want to do it, but I might get in trouble for it, so I'm not really certain. And they get that kind of schizophrenic nervousness to them, whereas if they're always in obedience all the time, you walk in a room, and I have these tables here in my little training area. I'll put a dog on those tables. I'll leave for an hour and a half training another dog, and I walk back in, and my dog's still laying on that table. And as soon as I walk in the room, he sits up, and he's all excited because he knows I'm going to tell him good job because he's been doing what he's supposed to do, and I'm going to walk over and love on him for it. And he's all confident because he knows this is where I'm supposed to be, and this is what I'm supposed to be doing right now. And and then when you do stuff, take him with you.
Yeah. Yeah, and the other thing is, like you talked about how they get in that nervous state. Or you get the really smart dog that goes, I'm not supposed to do this, but I only get in trouble when I get caught. Mm-hmm. So now, like, that mind goes, how do I get away with it? And that's where you end up with dogs like I had that learned how to open freaking doors and hide shit in advance before you left the house so you could pre-game things. Like, and neither one of those is good, right?
Yes.
I have a big brown stain on a carpet to prove that from a dog food can. Where the dog literally ate the can to get to the food inside the can. So, like, you're going to get either that paranoid state or you're going to get that calculating, how do I get away with it? And then it becomes a game. Yeah. And then dogs like games. They like to play. They like to have fun.
Right.
You know,
well, and they also want to know where they're like 3 to 5 year old kids. They want to know where a boundary is. And if you don't give them one, they'll keep, like, well, where is it? Where is the boundary? I want to know where it is.
Yeah.
And then you're just frustrated and mad at the dog rather than baseline level obedience, always do what you're supposed to do, and I'm good and I'm happy. Every time you hit this spot, I'm stopping you. You're never going to go beyond
that. If they were in a pack, that pack enforces a boundary. So that's just – they need. It's not mean. You know, I want to let the dog be a dog. Well, the dog can only be a dog if you treat the dog like a dog, and a dog, canine pack animal, will have boundaries within that pack. So, and you are the alpha, whether you want to be or not. The dog cannot be the alpha. And therefore, if you do not apply the boundary, you're not giving the dog what the dog needs to, in your words, be a dog. right?
Right.
Like, we don't know what a dog is because we've had too many fluffy schnuffies running around.
Exactly.
All right, we need to wrap up, Joel. Tell people again how they can learn more about you, do business with you, get in touch with you.
Absolutely. Well, you can buy Beyond the Bite, my new book, at fortresscanine.com. You can also go there and schedule a consultation if you're interested in getting a protection dog or puppies. We have puppies available and litters coming. And if you're interested in training a dog you already have, check out canineacademy.us. But what you need to do is go to thesurvivalpodcast.com and click on our banner so Jack gets credit for those purchases. And those are videos that are, we walk you step by step through exactly how we train our dogs. So we have a basic course there that's just your basic five obedience commands. We have an intermediate course that you can start doing some obstacles with the dog and it builds a stronger bond. And our advanced course takes you all the way up through off-lead obedience. So you can also find us on social media. Almost everywhere we are at Fortress Canine Dogs on social media, and that's YouTube, Instagram, and I think I'm Fortress Canine Kennels on Facebook because I lost my account years ago on that one.
Oh, I just wonder how that happened. Joel, man, thanks for being with us today.
My pleasure. Guys, have a great day.
You too, man. Thanks for hanging out. All right, folks, real quick before we wrap up, I just want to, you know, I shilled Joel's book, Beyond the Bite. I definitely think you should get a copy of this book, but you really, really, really need, if you don't have one yet, get a copy of Laws of Life, Book 1, Ditch the System, Design Your Life, second edition. If you have the first edition, I promise you it's worth it. I promise you it's worth the upgrade. Get your hands on it. It's great. I will let you guys know the audio version is now available. That took about half a day for Amazon to do that. It's done with virtual voice. I'm not in love with it. I explained yesterday why, if there's going to be an audiobook, I have to do it that way. I don't make hardly any money at all on audiobooks, but I want you guys to have it if you want it. I've been listening to it, and I picked the best voice I had available, and I'll let you know that the one weird thing he does, he says distill for the chapter distills, like distille or something. I don't know if he got French for a half a second, but there's a few things like that. But the virtual voice works if audio is your thing. But I'm going to tell you this. You guys asked me to write a book for freaking almost 20 years. I wrote a book. Now you want an audio. I have like 20,000 hours of audio. So get the book. Read the book. Workbooks are coming. And remember, the big announcement really is Laws of Life Book 2, June 30th. That is a Tuesday, right at the end of the month, 10 days after our 20th anniversary, or 18th anniversary of the show. You'll be able to get that book, and that'll be good too. And workbooks are coming. I was working on the workbook for Laws of Life 1 this morning. That's going to be really exciting because it's not just that it reinforces the laws and helps you put them into practice in your life. That process will actually teach you the psychology and the neuroscience behind why this stuff works. I also do have an item of the day for you today. This just came up on a pricing alert for me today. These are not an expensive item. They're not a super high quality item. But I have sold thousands of these, and no one has ever complained about them. These are the E-Tech City 4-pack of LED lanterns. They're about $20 and change for of them. They run off simple AA batteries. They even come with batteries, which makes them even less expensive. They simply work by pulling them up, and the lights come on. And they're great for a blackout kit. They're great for where the power's at, and you're getting set up with whatever backups you have. They're great for kids that are scared of the dark or whatever. Give them one to put on their night table or what have you. And I'm going to tell you the really great thing about this. I actually reached out to this company, E-Tech City, about some complaints of people saying, you know, I got a package and one of them was DOA. And they're like, well, you know, that person didn't contact us because all we do is just ship new ones. The guy was very honest with me. He said, we can't sell tens of thousands of electronic devices without having an occasional DOA. We just replace it. That's all you can ask for from a company. So I really recommend you check these guys out. Again, they're like 16% off today, and they're already a great deal. And remember, you can always support us by doing your online shopping at tspaz.com. No matter what you buy online, you'll find over 500 product reviews that I've done there over the years, and they're all things I spent my own money on. I wouldn't ask you to do it if I wouldn't spend my money on it, and they're things I trust. And I have tested. I've got some stuff right now I'm testing. I'm not completely ready to review it yet. It hasn't been through enough time to see if it's worth recommending. But no matter what you buy, if you start there, you'll help us out. Again, pick up a copy of my book. Let's push this thing up the bestsellers list a little bit from where it is. Laws of Life, Book 1, Ditch the System, Design Your Life. This is the second edition. I'm trying to get rid of that first edition. I'm still able to find it if I really try hard enough. Don't buy the first edition. Buy the second edition. If it doesn't have Book 1 in the title, it's not it. Check it out. And thanks to everybody that bought the first edition. Again, I promise you the second one's worth the upgrade. Take care, guys, and have a great day. I'll be back tomorrow with Expert Counsel Q&A show for the week.
Should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way. Revolution.